From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Melissa Block.
And I'm Audie Cornish. A top-rated liberal arts college admits it lied about its students' SAT scores. The school is Claremont McKenna College in California, and it submitted inflated scores to a national ranking service and to the federal government. As NPR's Larry Abramson reports, the incident could threaten the school's U.S. News and World Report ranking.
Claremont McKenna is a rising star among the nation's liberal arts colleges, but late yesterday, the school had to notify staff and students that a senior admissions official had deliberately falsified the SAT scores of students entering the school. The difference was relatively small, adding only 10 to 20 points to the average score, but Robert Morris, director of data research for U.S. News, says it still could have an impact on the school's ranking.
It's really not going to drop the school to 20th place, but I guess there's some chance that it could drop out of the top 10.
School President Pamela Gann recently touted the school's number 9 ranking in a list of achievements. In her message to students yesterday, Gann tried to limit the damage, saying this was the act of one person, no one else was involved. The school's accrediting body, the Western Association of Schools and Colleges, accepted this explanation and indicated there would be no negative consequences if the school handled the matter appropriately. But critics of the U.S. News ranking saw this episode as another sign the ratings race has gotten out of hand. Bob Schaefer with the organization Fair Test says it shows how silly it is to parse fine distinctions between similar schools.
To have single points separating schools between 9 and 11 on a ranking scale encourages them to manipulate their data to boost their ranking.
The same false data went to the U.S. Department of Education. The department said the school could face fines, but that is unlikely if this is, in fact, an isolated incident, the act of an admissions official gone rogue. Larry Abramson, NPR News.
The state of Florida is having a big year for politics. Today's primary, of course. In August, Tampa will host the Republican National Convention. And then there's the usual business of Florida's state government conducted in Tallahassee. Lawmakers have gathered for their annual session, knowing they'll be watched over once again by 71-year-old veteran journalist Lucy Morgan. NPR's Noah Adams has this profile.
On Monday night in Tallahassee, the eve of the new session, an outdoor reception to honor the Florida lawmakers. The alcohol is top shelf, the food sumptuous, the invitation specified business attire. This party is put on every year by a large lobbying association, and there are 2,000 people here. The governor, senators and representatives, lobbyists, and Lucy Morgan from the Tampa Bay Times.
It's a social occasion the night before session starts. The only business that would be conducted here tonight would be kind of surreptitious, and it would be lobbyists handing checks to legislators who, after tomorrow morning, can no longer collect.
Those checks would be campaign contributions, all legal. The legislators can take the money year-round, just not during the session. Lucy Morgan has often written about the lobbyists in Tallahassee, about their beach houses and Porsches, the millions they can earn, their power, their deep insider status at the Capitol.
The lobbyists are the most fascinating part of it to me and have always been, in my coverage here, something I paid major attention to because, first of all, they know more than the legislators do about what's going to happen. They usually know when it's going to happen, and they are the best predictors of exactly what is going to come out on the other end of the legislative train.
On the last day of the 2007 session, a bill was passed that included millions for an ultra-fancy state courthouse in Tallahassee. It was a last-minute addition to a 142-page bill. It did not attract attention. Then last year, with the courthouse about to be finished, Lucy Morgan put the story on the front page of her paper. The headline was Taj Mahal of a Court, approved without legislative scrutiny. Later, the Florida Senate, embarrassed by the courthouse, embarrassed even more by Lucy's follow-up stories, had questions for the judges who had been lobbying for the fancy building.
It's been determined that the legislature is totally at fault here for allocating the dollars. But we didn't put the African mahogany in there. We didn't put the granite countertops in there. We didn't decide that there was going to be two robing rooms. Who made those decisions?
the African mahogany.
Please tell us. Go ahead.
The African mahogany decision was actually made.
The judge, trying to get to answer that question, has now resigned, avoiding trial on misconduct charges. He has denied wrongdoing. Lucy Morgan's story had started with a tip. Somebody said, look at the email traffic from the judges about their new building. Soon she was searching through 1,300 messages.
And then I found, buried in the middle of those emails, one email from a judge that said, we got it. It's in House Bill 985 on its way to the governor. It was a lengthy transportation bill, and tacked on to the very end of it was a clause authorizing a $32 million bond issue to help pay for this courthouse, stuck in the middle of a bill that had nothing to do with courthouses or bond issues.
As we sit here today, I am hard-pressed to think of any reporter who can run a story like that other than Lucy Morgan.
That's Florence Snyder, a Tallahassee attorney who writes about media issues. Snyder says the Taj Mahal story was leaked to several news organizations, but Lucy Morgan was the one who had the ferocious, youthful curiosity necessary to take it on. Morgan is an investigative reporter. She's semi-retired, working half-time. Her newspaper, the Tampa Bay Times, was until recently called the St. Petersburg Times. For 20 years, she was the Capitol bureau chief. She was the boss. And when she left that job, they had a party and gave her a quilted wall hanging, looks like newsprint, with words sewn in. And this is how her colleagues described Lucy Morgan. Now every day she can look up from her desk and usually laugh.
Well, let's see, muckraker, ball buster, force of nature, cat lover, red wine please, bitch. Unfortunately, most of it's true.
Morgan was born in Hattiesburg, Mississippi, raised by her mom in a house that was full of music and books. Her sister went off to college at 15 and became a Harvard-trained psychologist. Lucy, at 17, was married. By the time she was 25, she had three children and was settled in Florida in the small town of Crystal River.
I was married to a high school football coach, and like anyone who's married to a coach or teacher, there was never any money.
And like any good life story, this one has a knock on the door. April 1965. An editor with the Ocala Star-Banner was standing there. She'd come to ask Lucy if she wanted to be a local correspondent.
And I said, well, I've never written anything. Why would you come to me? And she said, well, the local librarian had told her that I read more books than anybody else in town. And since I read so much, maybe I could write.
She signed on as a stringer, earning 20 cents a word. The city commission was on her beat. Those men were accustomed to sometimes telling reporters, y'all don't write this.
In the very first meeting I covered, I got in trouble with all of them because they went into not a private session, but just some discussion of whether they should fire the police chief, and I wrote it. It did not seem to me that you should let something like that go unreported.
Lucy went on to a full-time job with the St. Petersburg Times. She divorced the coach, married the editor, Dick Morgan of the Times.
I can tell you unequivocally, she is the best reporter that I've ever worked with or that I've ever known.
In 1985, Lucy won a Pulitzer Prize for a series on corruption in a sheriff's office. And then in 1986, she moved to Tallahassee to run the newspaper's Capitol Bureau. She did all this without ever taking a journalism course. A protest inside the Florida Capitol. The young people will make the evening television news. Lucy Morgan walks on past. She moves more slowly on the marble floors these days and with a limp. She fractured an ankle in the House Press Gallery 12 years ago. She takes me along to a back door of the Senate chamber.
Reporters used to stake this hall out all the time. I don't know where they all are now, but there's a bell that rings a couple of times to warn the senators that
yes,
it's a quorum call.
The senators move past, and the lobbyists are also in the hallway. Everybody smiles when they see Lucy, especially the lobbyist Ron Book, said to be the most powerful in the state. And Book knows Lucy is always looking for a story.
And she has been known to walk over and simply open up my pocket and take the paperwork out of my pocket. You see that I'm holding my notebook closed?
Look, I have made him look so important, he makes millions doing it.
Listener,
At day's end, Morgan drives home to the countryside north of town. She likes opera, so it's Pavarotti on the stereo, a glass of wine, and ice for her ankle. Lucy and Dick Morgan live only half the year in Tallahassee. In April, they'll escape the coming hot weather by settling into their cabin in the North Carolina mountains. They'll take the computer, and she'll watch for that next story to come along.
Dick's 81, I'm 71. I don't know what I'm going to do. As long as it's fun, my health is good enough to do it, and I'm interested in doing it, I may do it, but I don't really intend to be doddering around in my 90s doing it.
Noah Adams, NPR News.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Melissa Block.
And I'm Audie Cornish. Not long ago, two obscure copyright bills, nicknamed SOPA and PIPA, seemed certain to win congressional approval. Then came SOPA Blackout Day. Several big Silicon Valley companies and internet activists joined forces to stop the bills, and Congress backed down. But NPR's Joel Rose reports that the coalition now faces a new challenge, agreeing on what to do next.
For months, opponents of SOPA, the Stop Online Piracy Act, in the House, and its sister bill PIPA, the Protect IP Act, in the Senate, complained to anyone who would listen that the bills would chill free speech on the internet. And they were pretty much ignored until January 18th, when Wikipedia and Google joined a 24-hour online protest.
5,000 petitions a minute to Congress, 4 million tweets on SOPA and PIPA, 9 million people signing petitions to their members of Congress.
Markham Erickson is executive director of Net Coalition, which represents web companies including Google and eBay.
We've never seen anything like that grassroots reaction to a bill passing through Congress, especially one having to do with copyright law.
At the heart of critics' concerns were provisions in the bills that they say would have made a website like Wikipedia liable for so much as linking to a page that's suspected of copyright infringement. And Congress took note. SOPA and PIPA were both shelved indefinitely, to the dismay of their backers, including Michael O'Leary at the Motion Picture Association of America. O'Leary says his group will still push for ways to protect American movies and music from so-called rogue websites that he says are currently beyond the reach of U.S. law.
Right now, we have very little recourse against people who sit offshore and steal American products. So I cannot tell you what form the response will come in. I can't tell you when. But there is still an understanding, a common understanding, which I think is shared by all parties to this debate, that something needs to be done to address this problem.
The MPAA and other content creators might take comfort from this line in President Obama's State of the Union address.
It's not right when another country lets our movies, music, and software be pirated.
In other words, SOPA and PIPA may be history, but this debate is far from over, and opponents of those bills, like Josh Levy, know it.
There will be more things coming down the horizon that we will have to look out for, and that's why we have to get out in front of them.
Levy is the campaign director at Free Press, one of many nonprofits that joined in the fight against the two bills. He wants to see the internet community craft an online bill of rights, or even push for a legislative alternative to SOPA. One such alternative is the Open Act, a copyright enforcement bill sponsored by Congressman Daryl Issa of California and Senator Ron Wyden of Oregon. Levy says that bill is better than SOPA, but he isn't ready to commit to it just yet.
The next step is to find consensus about what's the best way to unite all of these millions of supporters of the internet. We don't have the answers necessarily right now, but we know that we have a lot of momentum on our side and we have a lot of people on our side, and that's new.
But is it enough? Without big web companies like Wikipedia and Google joining the cause, SOPA and PIPA might have gone from obscure copyright bills to obscure copyright laws. And Wikipedia, at least, does not seem to be interested in rewriting the rules that govern the internet. Jay Walsh is a spokesman for the Wikimedia Foundation, which runs the online encyclopedia.
What Wikimedia and what the people who edit Wikipedia really want to do is edit Wikipedia. Advocacy isn't our subject area of expertise, nor is how to prevent online piracy, to be honest.
Walsh wouldn't rule out another protest if Wikipedia's interests are threatened again. But without the web's sixth largest site on their side, internet activists may once again find it hard to get Congress and the country to pay attention to the finer points of copyright law. Joel Rose, NPR News.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Audie Cornish.
And I'm Melissa Blogg. Today was Super Bowl Media Day in Indianapolis, and normally that would be what you'd expect, a day for media. But this year, something new occurred. For the first time, fans were allowed inside the stadium. For a modest fee, they could witness a vast horde of notebook-toting reporters descending on Giants and Patriots players and coaches. Kurt Nickisch of member station WBUR was there, and he survived to send this report.
Media Day is a marvel of modern sports hype. A sea of video cameras and microphones crowds football players on the field where the Super Bowl will be played. Sports reporters are dwarfed by the players they're interviewing, and TV hosts in platform shoes pose for stand-ups.
Yeah, and then we're going to pull on out, and Sierra, you're going to say, with the Patriots.
Meanwhile, the star players and coaches sit in booths for more than an hour to answer back-to-back questions. Because the game's being held in Indianapolis, where Peyton Manning and the Colts play, half the questions for New York Giants quarterback Eli Manning were about his older brother.
Peyton and I, when we go home, we still sleep in bunk beds.
What's different this year is the in-house audience. More than 7,000 football fans were in the stands, watching the coordinated chaos unfold.
Having a ball.
Reggie McGee, like everyone else in the stands, got an earpiece to wear. He could look up at the big screen to see which player was being broadcast on which channel, and then could listen in on the simultaneous press conferences.
I've been flipping back and forth. Very interesting. I like it.
He'd better like it. He dropped $25 to get in the building to watch TV hosts swarm the players like ants and listen to players answer the same questions over and over. Well worth it to Patriots fan Brian Ragland.
This is amazing. I mean, I don't know why they didn't do it before. I don't know why they didn't sell 50,000 seats. It's awesome.
What's so awesome? To see the players without their helmets on, to see the TV personalities they know from ESPN and Extra. Katie Darrell from HDNet didn't mind being part of the paid show.
I'm having a blast. I mean, come on. This is pretty much every dude in America's dream right now, so if you can't enjoy it for that, then you're just a jerk.
The whole event lasted more than 3 hours. The length of time, the amount of access, that's what's always made Media Day such an event. Now the NFL has figured it's another way to bring in revenue and build excitement for the Super Bowl on Sunday. Although the New England Patriots coach didn't help the cause, for more than an hour, the tight-lipped Bill Belichick deflected probing questions, answering with zen-like brevity.
We have a lot of respect for the Giants.
Wouldn't you pay $25 to listen to that? For NPR News, I'm Kurt Nickisch in Indianapolis.
And now we turn to the industry that has driven Detroit's ups and downs, the auto industry. Like the city itself, the big three car companies, GM, Chrysler, and Ford, have gone through their own hard times. Back in 2008, we heard this from then-Chrysler CEO Bob Nardelli. This was in a hearing before a congressional committee.
Chrysler is requesting a $7 billion loan to bridge the current financial crisis. And in exchange, Chrysler is committed to continue our restructuring.
That was then. In 2011, the big three reported market share increases for the first time in decades, and American automakers posted a 10% increase in sales. Part of the restructuring Nardelli talked about was a controversial industry contract with the United Auto Workers that drastically cut wages and benefits for all new hires, essentially creating a two-tier wage system for the big three. We wanted to know more about how this is working out, so we've called upon the Detroit Free Press's Brent Snavely. He reports on the auto industry. Also with us is the president of UAW's Local 845, Allison Hugg. She took a buyout when Ford was in crisis, but she was later hired back to the same plant as an entry-level employee, and they're both here with us, and we got in touch with her through the UAW. Thank you both so much for joining us.
Hi, Michelle. Thanks for having us.
Thank you. Thanks for giving us the opportunity to be on the air.
So, Brent, let me start with you, because I think that most people can understand why the automakers would want to pay lower wages. Why did the auto union, why did the UAW agree?
Well, if we go back to 2007, which is just 1 year before that tape that you played with Bob Nardelli there, Back in 2007, the Detroit Three had been losing market share for many, many years. Their labor costs had been increasing, and the UAW recognized that it needed to accept drastic actions in order to make the UAW competitive. And they really turned their attention to looking long-term into the future so that they could gain jobs in the future so that both the UAW and the automakers could survive, and they realized that they needed to be partners in that future.
Allison, do you remember the debate over that? You were working at a Ford parts plant when these changes started. Do you remember any debate over that? Did you ever think it would have anything to do with you?
Not that it would have anything to do with me. We had to make the decisions and keep the auto companies viable, and we did what we had to do.
So as I recall your situation, you were working for a Ford parts plant when the changes started, and at the time, you decided for various reasons to take a buyout. But then your plans that for the buyout period didn't pan out. You wanted to start a business that didn't work as you had hoped.
Right.
So then after 2 months, you were hired back to the same plant, this time under new ownership. As I understand it, you're making half the wage, $14 an hour, for doing the same work that you had done at $28 an hour. Is that right?
At this time, I make $16.50. So at the time I hired back in, yeah, I was making $14. But over the years, I've increased.
But not back to where you were. Can I just ask how that makes you feel when you do the work? Are you like irritated when you get your check, or what do you look at it and think, what?
No, I did what I did, and I knew what I was coming back to, and that was my personal decision when I went out.
What about the relationships within the plant? Do people know who's making what?
Oh, sure. I mean, it's like anywhere you get hired. When I hired in 94, I was making less than the Ford employee that was next to me. So it's a progression.
We're talking about the auto industry's two-tier wage system with Allison Hugg. She works in a parts plant near Detroit, and also Brent Snavely of the Detroit Free Press. He reports on this. You know, Brent, we caught up with a Ford employee who makes the higher-tier wage. He's part of a group that is vocally opposed to it. It's called the Auto Workers Caravan, and we were able to grab a quote from him about his take on what the new system says about the company. I'll just play it for you.
Their model was, if you work for Ford, you should be able to buy their product. But when you're cutting wages like you are now, it makes it hard to purchase products with the increase in the cost of living. So it's hard to have one person raise a family on just a two-tier wage. It just almost can't be done.
That was Eric Truss. So, Brent, to your knowledge, does that represent the attitudes of most of the people that you talk about?
It represents the attitudes of many that I talk with. And one of the things that happens to me as a reporter is that by default I get phone calls from the loudest, angriest, most active folks. So it does represent a significant segment, but there are others that are perfectly happy with the entry-level wage. And one of the things I want to sort of back up and underline is recognize that in 2007, the deal, as you accurately described it, was new hires would be hired at the lower tier wage. They didn't exist in 2007, and then we went through a recession for a couple of years, and very few new hires were hired at that wage for a couple of years. So this was a major controversy within the UAW for a long time, but it continues to bubble up and become a current controversy now, because now is when the Detroit Three are actually growing and hiring people at that wage.
One of the things, Allison, that is you can't help but notice is that when they are hiring, thousands of people apply for the positions that are available. And I'm wondering if that's kind of in your mind. I mean, I know you were rehired in part because of the work that you had done previously, your attendance and so forth, and your skill, obviously. But is that part of your mind when you're thinking about the fact that you accepted a lower wage?
No, because I know there's progression and we all have to start here and build our way up, and we're not going to stay entry-level employees. There's that chance and opportunity to get to the Tier 1 Ford again.
Sometimes, does anybody ever think you shouldn't have accepted that wage? Does anybody ever say, oh, you shouldn't have done it, you should have held out, or we should have held out? Does that feeling still exist?
I mean, that came with the negotiating and everything that comes at a higher level. So I signed to do what I did. And
do you feel comfortable with your decision?
Yes.
You feel okay with it?
Mm-hmm.
What do you think? What is your sense of the feelings among the people that you work with? Do you feel that most people are pretty comfortable with it? Even if they don't like it, they can accept it?
They can accept it.
Now, I understand that the 2011 contract raised wages for entry-level employees you've been talking about, that it also provided for more profit sharing and improved on health care benefits. Are you feeling that? Are you seeing that?
Oh, absolutely. Mm-hmm. Yep. I mean, they've gained so much in this last contract, the paid vacation, paid personal time, bereavement, jury duty, co-pays for office visits, things that they didn't have. So
you feel like you're making progress.
Absolutely, making progress.
Brent Snavely, what about you? I just want to get your perspective on that. Is there a sense kind of in the industry that things are getting better?
Oh, absolutely. We've now had 2 years in a row where the U.S. auto sales have increased about 10% in 2010, an additional 10% in 2011, and forecasts are for about an 8% increase this year. And along with that, the Detroit 3 gained market share, a small amount, but they gained market share, as you said earlier, because they, for a lot of reasons, but one reason is that they've improved their products. And so there is a tremendous amount of hope and optimism for in a better future.
And I'm going to put you on the spot here and ask you the same question that I asked the mayor earlier, which is there a sense that the progress that the automakers are making, that the industry is making, is that, I don't like the term trickling down, but I'll use it, can't think of a better one, is that it's improving the city, the area, this community? Are people feeling it in the community?
I would say no, not yet, but I think it will. And to your point about, I mean, this was stunning to me. Chrysler recently announced that it would hire 1,100 additional workers at a plant in Detroit early next year, but they made the announcement recently. So my phone lines get flooded with calls from unemployed people when I write that story. Chrysler tells me they already have 10,000 job applications on file for those jobs before they announced that they would do the additional hiring. So the level of unemployment in Michigan and in Detroit and in this nation has not recovered, and it's not going to recover, best case scenario, for another 10 years to the point level that it was at in 1999. Things will get better, but you would need to see such a level of improvement to get back to where things were just 10 years ago that and it's almost impossible to see that coming. But yes, things will get better, just not back to 1999.
Allison, really briefly, do you think your life is getting better?
My life is good.
Okay. Glad to hear. Well, you look good.
Thank you.
That's awesome. Allison Hugg is the president of UAW's Local 845. She's actually experienced the two-tier wage system on both sides. She was here with us at member station WDET in Detroit for this special broadcast from Detroit. Also with us, Brent Snavely. He covers the auto industry for the Detroit Free Press. Thank you both so much for joining us.
Thank you, Michelle.
Thank you.
Please stay with us. In a minute, we'll go to our moms for their take on teaching tolerance in school and at home. Joining us will be one of the moms profiled in the All-American Muslim series. This is Tell Me More from NPR News. Please stay with us.